It's Kelly Clarkson here to talk all things Wayfair, the best place to buy furniture, decor, and anything else you can think of to create a home you absolutely love. I know when I shop with Wayfair, I find options for every style, whether I'm feeling boho or farmhouse, modern, traditional, French country. I can find exactly what I need for my home and more. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to make your home way more you.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Moali.
Welcome back to another episode of the Sexology podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Moali, and today's conversation is one I've been especially excited to share with you. We're joined by Dr. Ellie Sheff, a trailblazing sociologist, educator, and one of the world's leading experts on consensual non-monogamy and polyamorous families. In this episode, we explore a deeply personal and often misunderstood relationship style, solo amory. Dr. Ellie shares her own journey, led her away from traditional couplehood and toward a life anchored in autonomy, connection, and self-trust. We dive into the emotional shift, the unexpected joys and challenges of living without the societal blueprint of quote-unquote the one. Whether you heard the term solo-amory before or this is your first encounter, this episode will open your mind to new possibilities around love, fulfillment, and self-definition. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Wifey, a beautifully crafted sex-positive platform that goes far beyond clickbait portrayal of ethical non-monogamy. Wifey provides an authentic, educational, and deeply human look into diverse relationship structures, including hot-wifing. If you're curious about love, trust, and desire outside the box, visit wifey.vmg.studio and follow them on Instagram at wifeyupdates. They're normalizing nuanced relational wellness with stories that challenge outdated scripts and spark compassion, curious conversations. All right, let's dive in. Here's my conversation with Dr. Ellie Sheff. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Sexology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Moali. I am so excited to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Eli Sheff to our show today. Dr. Eli, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're so excited to have you on our show. We're redoing a series on consensual non-monogamy and different relationship structures. And I know this is an area of expertise that you have. And I know you talk a lot about solo-amory. Before we're diving into that dynamic, for people who are not familiar with it, can you give them a brief definition of what solo-amory means?
I think of solo-amory. It's not actually a term I use that much, but I think of it as love for the self and independent, kind of more autonomous love for oneself, not necessarily focused on relationships with other people.
That is such a unique perspective, right? Because when we're thinking about connections, most people think about connections with others. So I was very unfamiliar with the term until a few years ago. So I'm kind of curious to learn about your own journey on your relationships, your personal life. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. When I was a young woman, I did not date very much. Like in high school, for instance, when my friends were dating, I just didn't date very much. And then when I got in my first really serious relationship, first it was with a man that surprised me. I didn't think I would want to be with a man, but I fell in love with him, surprise. And he said that he would never want to be monogamous or get married. And when he very first told me that, actually on our first date, I thought, whatever, you know, I didn't really care because I didn't anticipate being in a serious relationship with him. But then once I realized that I had fallen in love with him, and I was really freaked out about that. I was like, what does that mean? You don't want monogamy. You don't want marriage. And I think I had what in retrospect was a very monogamous response to that, thinking, oh, this must mean that I'm not enough for him, that I'm too fat, I'm not good in bed, I'm boring, I'm, you know, whatever, which I, now that I know more about this, I realize is a pretty standard reaction among monogamous people who hear from their partners that they want polyamory, that the monogamous people feel initially like, oh no, what's inadequate about me that you need other people? And he explained that it wasn't any inadequacy on my part, that no matter who he was with, he would always want multiple partners. So I needed to think about that. And I was wondering, is my knee-jerk reaction against this, is it because society tells me monogamous relationships are the only real relationships and everyone should want to be in a monogamous relationship? Or is it because I really want exclusivity and I actually really don't want a multiple partner relationship? So being the intellectual that I am, I intellectualize things that frighten me, and eventually decided, after checking it out as what I think of as a civilian, meaning looking into it just to see how other people deal with it and how it might impact my life and how people manage multiple partners and manage the emotional reaction to their partner wanting other people, I decided, all right, I'm going to study this and I'm going to understand it, and then I'll feel okay about it. And ironically, 30 years later, after studying it deeply, I do feel okay about it, but feeling okay about it doesn't mean that I want it. I have realized over that time that some people are, I think of it as being wired for multiplicity, that is just a feature of their internal makeup, you know, very much like a sexual orientation. It's a relational orientation that they want multiple partners, and that I am wired for exclusivity, and that's not something I can change or turn off. So while I understand polyamory intellectually and absolutely certain that it is certainly the best relationship format for some people and works really well for some people, and in fact is the only satisfying relational format for some people, it just doesn't work for me. Once I'm in love with someone, I do not want multiple partners. I am not interested in anyone else. And if I start to feel interested in someone else, once I'm in love with someone, that is a red flag for me. It does mean that there's something going wrong in my relationship, which is not true for people who are wired for polyamory or multiple partners, that if they love someone and then experience attraction to someone else, it very much does not mean that there's something wrong in their home relationship or their original relationship or with the first person that they were already with, that they can love multiple people. They truly can. And it doesn't mean that they don't love their other partner.
I love that. Thank you for sharing your experiences and also your work, clinical work and research around it and how things shape for you. I guess what I'm curious about is the experience of many of our own clients that oftentimes people get introduced or get interested, and not always, but sometimes, and consensual non-monogamy, including polyamory, by a partner that's similar to what you said, that they want, that's their relationship orientation, and that's what they recommend. And sometimes people don't want to explore it, or they have reservation because cultural script, and sometimes it's because it's truly, they're not sure if it's a match for them or not. For you, like, did you experiment that with polyamory or open relationship? Was there any signs that you felt, okay, this is not for me? Is that how you arrived at it, or mostly was from observational through others?
It was definitely direct experience that with my first partner who wanted polyamory, I was not at all interested in other people until he pushed so hard for polyamory that he pushed me away. And then I did get interested in someone else, and it meant that I fell out of love with him, my original partner, and was not in love with him anymore. My second partner, so I've had two marriages, two polymono marriages, ironically, where I was the monogamous person and the other person was polyamorous. My second partner, when we first got together, she said, I need you to know I have cheated on everyone I've ever been with. And I think she is very much wired for multiplicity. And I said, well, let's just set it up so you don't have to cheat. And at that time, I had divorced my husband and been single for about 5 years. And during that time, I was dating and realized that I could date people and not feel jealous if they dated other people and not want exclusivity with them. And what I wasn't noticing as much was I wasn't falling in love with any of these people. Well, I very much fell in love with my now ex-wife and noticed as soon as I was in love with her, I was not attracted to other people. Even though I met someone during my relationship with her that would otherwise, I think, have been exactly my type, I was not interested in developing a relationship with this woman who she and I are still friends to this day. Like, I really like her a lot, but it never became a romantic thing. So realizing that no matter how many opportunities I had, I just was not interested in multiple partners was really significant for me. That when I'm not in love, I can date around and that's no problem. But when I'm in love, I am really very exclusive. And that ironically, I can manage my partner having multiple partners as long as they meet my needs sufficiently, then I'm okay with them being with other people. And I don't feel driven to be with other people. It takes a bit of challenge for me. It's not effortless. I do need to kind of move back, step back to let them have the space to see other people, and that comes at the cost for me of introducing some distance into the relationship. But it was well worth it for me when my wife was meeting my needs. What ruined that for me was when she fell in love with someone else and was just ignoring me and not giving me attention, stopped having sex with me and was only having sex with her new girlfriend, blowing me off, not, you know, at first not coming to the times that we had arranged to hang out together. And then when I got upset about that, she said, oh, that'll never happen again. And I thought she meant it would never happen again, that she would blow me off, that we would make a date and she would just not show up. It turned out what she meant was she would never make plans with me again. And if we just happened to hang out, that would be fine, but she wouldn't intentionally make plans with me, so she couldn't accidentally not show up. And I don't know if she meant to do that on purpose, but that's how it worked out. So after a while, I was like, this is not working. I need you to do these things if I'm going to be in relationship with you, and gave her, you know, a list of like, this isn't working. And she just said no, rather than like, I can't do that, but I could do this. She didn't really negotiate with me. She just said no. Like, one of the things I wanted her to call or text me every day, which I know is something she does in relationship. You know, when she's really excited about someone, she calls or texts them multiple times every day. And I wanted her to do that with me, to court me as well. And she said no. So I eventually broke off that relationship as well. And since then, have realized that I'm in this kind of challenging spot of being really attracted to the freedom and the autonomy of polyamory, where people are more open to life experience and they don't have to be glued at the hip to their partner all the time. So I like that aspect of multiple partner relating, but I just don't want the multiple partners. So what I want is an autonomous version of exclusivity. So I think of myself as monogamish, that I would much prefer exclusivity, but if I met a partner who really wanted other partners, as long as they met my needs, I can do that. You know, that if that's the price I pay for the degree of autonomy that I want, and the degree of flexibility and the ability to kind of have relationships shift and grow and change over time, which is another feature of consensual non-monogamies. I'm willing to kind of make that trade-off of, if I get this much autonomy, then you get multiple partners. But what I would really like is to meet another autonomous, monogamous person who has, you know, a lot of love and energy for me, but also has their own life that they want to go off and do things, and allows in air quotes, because I don't really think we need to allow each other, but gives me the grace of also being autonomous, of doing things on my own or having my own experiences and relationships and relationships with friends, that they don't need to be glued to me and do everything together. I do like doing things together with my beloved, but I also like time by myself, or time to be just doing my own thing, but in a way that they trust me to do that and don't feel the need to monitor me.
Well, it seems like you have reflected, kind of like experimented with different relationship dynamics, and you arrive at a place that you feel grounded on what works. And to me, mono-poly dynamic can be, at least for many of my clients, is very, very challenging, because it's required lots of setting boundaries, communication, and even at times rituals. How did you manage the jealousy piece? Because that's one of the biggest hindrances that people experience in that any dynamic, but specifically in mono-poly.
You know, I just don't feel a lot of jealousy. I do feel insecurity. So, for instance, when my wife stopped having sex with me and was having sex with her girlfriend, I felt, oh, well, of course she wants this other person more than me, because she was younger and prettier and thinner and probably better in bed, you know, all these reasons. So it wasn't like I was jealous of their relationship, but more that I felt insecure about it. And that was painful for me. When at other points, my wife had been giving me enough attention and my needs were met, I didn't necessarily feel that way. You know, when she was expressive of her love for me and gave me attention and showed me desire, I was fine with her having sex with other people, and it just didn't bother me. somehow. And I think, ironically, like that part of my personality is kind of wired for polyamory, because when I talk to my respondents in my research, I realize that some people have a lot of jealousy, and it's something that they deal with a lot, and a lot of things kind of activate that jealousy. So in my mind, over time, I came to kind of have this image of jealousy as like nodes in your brain. And people who are high in jealousy have a lot of jealousy nodes, and they're activated by a lot of things. People who are very low in jealousy have few jealousy nodes, and they don't get activated by many things at all. Some of my respondents reported that they had literally never felt jealousy and didn't understand the emotion. And then ironically, it happened with the fourth wave of data collection. Between the third and fourth waves of data collection, four people who had said that they had never experienced jealousy then had an experience that brought jealousy up for them. And it was similar for each one of them. First, that something went wrong in their life. For one person, he started losing his hair and gained some weight and was just feeling not nearly as attractive. You know, he was getting older and his body changed, and he went from feeling like super kind of magnetic to a little dumpy. And that was really difficult for him. For another person, he lost his job that he had felt very identified with, and it gave him a sense of accomplishment and kind of a sense of mastery in the world. And then he was laid off. For another person, she had had a baby that she loved the baby. That having the baby itself wasn't a bad thing. But she had not only postpartum body, where her body changed during pregnancy and then afterwards, she had stretch marks and folds where she'd never had folds before, but she felt just bedraggled. She wasn't getting enough sleep. You know, she didn't have enough time to kind of do some of the things for herself that she used to be able to do. So she just wasn't feeling as attractive. Things like that, that something happens in their life. Then simultaneously, while they're experiencing this kind of decline in personal desirability or something, you know, some kind of negative thing happens to them, their beloved partner meets someone new that they're very excited about. And this new person is fantastic somehow, you know, younger, prettier, more interesting, more exciting, has more money, has a better job, you know, somehow they are really very exciting. And their beloved partner is spending a lot of time and energy with this new person. And one of my respondents, the one who had lost his job, and then his beloved partner of years and years, connected with someone else who was very successful and good looking, said he felt terrible because he realized how out of control jealousy feels, like he couldn't just turn it off, and how incredibly painful it was emotionally that he felt bad because he had poo-pooed his partners in the past because he couldn't really relate to the concept of jealousy. He was like, you're just making too much out of this. Like, you need to just calm down about this. You know, you're really kind of dramatic about this. And then once he experienced jealousy, he was like, oh, this sucks. Like, this really hurts. And it's not something you can just calm down about. Like, it's really bad internally. So I think the people who are, I think of the orientation of exclusivity to multiplicity as kind of a spectrum. And the people who are way over on the spectrum of multiplicity probably have few jealousy nodes. They're just wired with that. And not that much activates them. And I think, strangely, that is my personality, that I don't deal with jealousy that much, that if my partner is really interested in someone else, I'm much more likely to go towards insecurity than jealousy. And they're related, you know, they're kind of sister emotions in a way, and insecurity is no fun. I have many insecurity nodes that all sorts of things activate them.
Aren't we all? How would you, like, I was thinking of a cousin, like a jealousy and insecurity to me is very close. How would you differentiate it?
Jealousy to me is more outward facing of, I want this, I want you to go away, I'm nervous about this external thing happening, and this person that I want is focused on someone else, and I am focused externally on this outward thing that's happening. Insecurity, at least for me, when I experience it, it's an internal thing of, I'm not enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not, you know, whatever. So the kind of solution to insecurity is to bolster my self-esteem and work on things internally for me that I feel aren't living up to the way I want to be, or to more likely focus more on self-love, that wrapping back around to solo amory, focus more on loving and accepting myself and not looking for that externally. Whereas the solution for jealousy is this external thing to make that other person go away so you can have the thing that you want. And I think for many people, insecurity is underneath jealousy, that there's a top layer of forward-facing jealousy with an underneath layer of internalized insecurity. And I'm not sure why I don't experience that top layer as much. It's not a feature of my personality very much. I'm not saying that I've never felt it. I'm just saying that I am much more likely every time to go towards insecurity rather than jealousy.
And thank you for sharing that, as far as like how, first of all, based on your research, there could be so many things that when we experience emotion like jealousy, it could be multifaceted. It could be how we feel about ourselves. I know for some people it could be childhood kind of trauma, relational trauma. So it's just like so multifaceted. And hearing that, I can imagine it's very validating for some of our listeners that they struggle with it. Because what I find that sometimes people feel shame around it. Oh my God, I have this. This is bad. But understanding where it's coming from, or understanding what are some of the origin story around it, can help people with bringing more compassion toward it. I know you wrote different places about solo amory. Is that something that you have experienced around it yourself? Is it about your clinical work? Tell us a little bit about that.
Definitely. I would say both. That in my research on multiple partner relationships, the people who seem most successful and secure in their relationships are the people who have a very strong grounding in themselves. By strong grounding, I don't necessarily mean narcissism, which can feel like a strong grounding in the self, but it's also kind of wobbly. You know, narcissists need a lot of attention from the outside. They are very much about themselves, but that needs to be constantly reinforced with attention from other people. What I mean is a strong sense of positive sense of self that isn't necessarily dependent on other people. And that often is coupled with the ability to be happy by themselves, to feel content with their own company, to feel good about themselves. And for me, I guess that translates to having, you know, enjoying my own company. For whatever reason, I am never bored. It's not something I experience. I think in part because I have ADHD, which means my brain is very jumpy. I think of it as sparkly brain. I have a very sparkly brain that has all of these ideas. And in fact, it's kind of nice for me to hang out by myself because I can just play with my brain and all these exciting ideas I have that when I'm with other people, it's kind of tiring in a way to try to be with that conversation and think about, you know, if I'm in a conversation and then I have 89 different responses in my brain and really only 5 of them are even relevant to the conversation. And of those 5, there's really only 2 or 3 that would be appropriate to say out loud. So I need to kind of do a lot of sifting to get to that. And often by the time I've chosen, oh, this is relevant and it's appropriate to say out loud, the conversation has moved on. So then I'm on, you know, down to another 127 things that I'm thinking about in response to the conversation happening. So it's kind of more restful for me in a way to be by myself. And I notice that some people, for instance, have a really hard time eating out by themselves or going to movies or doing things alone and feel concerned that other people are looking at them and judging them for eating out by themselves, for instance. And that literally had never occurred to me until I read an article where this person was talking about how difficult it was for them to eat out by themselves and how they felt like people were looking at them and judging them, like, why is that person alone and in a restaurant? And I was just like, you're alone in a restaurant because you want to eat food and you're doing your own thing. Like, of course you're alone in a restaurant. That's really not a thing. That's not a problem. So I think that kind of wrapping back around to that sense of autonomy that I really value and is just a strong feature of my personality is part of solo amory. And then for me, ironically, since I left my wife, my ex-wife, that the end of that relationship was really devastating for me. And I realized that once I'm in love with someone, if I don't fall out of love with them, I remain in love with them. So it's been 5 years since we broke up, and I'm still in love with her, and I miss her still. And I haven't really felt available, emotionally available to other people, so I haven't been dating, really, although I just started that. But I have, over those 5 years, tried to do romantic things for myself that I would have wanted from a relationship. So light candles for myself and tell myself little secrets, you know, and be sweet on and to myself the way I experience that sweetness. If I'm in love with a romantic partner, I have a lot of kind of excitement and attention for them. And I've really, over these past 5 years, focused on wrapping that back to myself. And it's actually been really healing for me that the end of that relationship was absolutely devastating for me and very painful, even though I would rather be by myself than be in a relationship where I feel ignored and taken for granted. And I would not say abused. She was not abusive, but she was certainly neglectful but wanted a lot of attention from me, but did not want to reciprocate with that. And I would rather be alone than that. So even though I feel like I made the right choice and it was the right thing to leave that relationship, it was incredibly painful and difficult for me and shattered me for a good 5 years. And coming out of that, I think, solo amory or focusing on myself and developing a more kind of romantic relationship with myself has really helped calm me down and help me feel I could date now I feel like I'm actually emotionally available for that. And if I never date again, or if I never couple with anyone again, I'm okay with that. I would rather be solo and have a sense of authenticity and self-respect than settle for a relationship that feels bad but gives me some modicum of attention.
Well, I'm sorry you experienced a painful breakup. I'm grateful that you are reinvesting in the love and attention to yourself. Thank you for sharing your journey with our listeners. I bet they can, it resonates with many of them. With solo amory, is it something that people can cultivate, or you think it's something that's innate?
I would say it's both. I think people have varying degrees of autonomy or a drive to be by themselves or to be kind of doing their own thing. But I also think it's a skill that people can cultivate and intentionally foster a relationship with themselves. And how to foster that, I guess, is one of the things I wonder. For me, at least, it was noticing this kind of missing her and this outward sense of I want her, I miss her. And I would think about, well, what is it that I want from her? What is it that I miss about her? What of that can I do for myself? What of that can I find inside myself? And part of that was being willing and able to kind of sit with this space inside that initially felt really kind of scary and empty, that I now welcome as a sense of expansiveness and openness. But part of the thing I think about solo amory is a willingness to kind of sit with whatever internal experience you are having. And that's easy when you feel good about yourself, and can be very difficult when that internal experience is painful or emptiness or sadness, but well worth it in the end, because even if you do find external distractions, that experience will still be there. So for me, facing those painful feelings was incredibly unpleasant, like really very difficult. And I am very grateful to a good therapist. At least for me, having a good therapist made a really big difference. I've had quite a bit of therapy across my life, and some of my therapists have been fantastic, and some of them have been pretty bad. You know, so I would say if anybody out there is interested in therapy and you feel like the connection you have with your therapist is not good, seek another therapist. It doesn't mean necessarily that therapy doesn't work for you. Maybe that connection with that specific therapist isn't the right one for you. But I just lucked out with a really good therapist during that time who was incredibly helpful and helped me to kind of ride that very painful, and it just went on, and that was very difficult. But now on the kind of on the other side of it, in a way, I feel like I developed a level of endurance for self-contact and self-reflection and, you know, being able to tolerate those difficult feelings, which I think is a life skill that everyone needs. And I had certainly worked on that a lot in the past as well, but this was a whole other level of pain that I had not experienced before.
I agree with you that it sounds like it's a combination of different skills and support that help you to be arriving at this place of readiness again to explore partnership. It's more in a grounded place. And I agree with you with therapist. I often tell people, like, I feel credential matters. Like, you want to make sure someone that have the right kind of like training. But other than that, it is a match. It's like dating, right? You might love someone, their profile and dating apps, but when you meet them, you don't have that connection. And I think with therapy, it's absolutely the same. And well, how wonderful that you were able to match with someone, that you built that strong connection and they support you in this journey. For our listeners that they want to learn more about you, Dr. Eli, what are some of the places they can find you?
One of the best places to start is my blog on Psychology Today. I blog under the name of my first book, which is The Polyamorists Next Door. And that's a very extensive blog with hundreds of blogs. And especially the first 10 years of that blog really focuses on the findings of my research, kind of broken up into little tidbit-sized nuggets, you know, that you can read for free and in an approachable way that you don't have to read some of my academic articles. You know, like, not everyone subscribes to the Journal of Contemporary Ethnography, so that's not as easy to read. But the Psychology Today blog is, I would say, the best place to start. If you want books, The Polyamorist Next Door tells about the first 15 years of my research. Children in Polyamorous Families is a very short book that summarizes my findings on the families with children. When someone you love is polyamorous is a great way to introduce consensual non-monogamies to other people. And unfortunately, that book is out of print right now, but it's going to be coming back. I'm in the process of republishing it. And Stories from the Polycule is also out of print, unfortunately. That's an edited volume that is kind of a life in the day of polyamory, a day in the life of polyamory. I also do relationship coaching, focusing especially on the non-monogamy kind of mixed dynamic where one person wants exclusivity and another person wants multiple partners. Or sometimes both people want multiple partners, but they want different kinds of multiplicity. Or even both people want exclusivity, but they want different kinds of exclusivity. So I do relationship coaching. I'm also developing a relationship test with my colleagues called the Bonding Project, and that's at bondingproject.com. And it helps people consider if they want to bond one-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-many, or solo. And we are coming very close to releasing new findings from that and new results. Right now, the test is up, but you don't get results because we've had issues in technological issues in the back of the house, and we are on the verge of fixing those. So hopefully very soon people will be able to take that test and get real, effective, authentic results tailored for them.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for mentioning all of these resources and sharing your lived experience, clinical experience, and research with us. Thank you for your time. We'll have you in our future episodes.
Thank you so much for having me.
As we close today's episode, I hope Dr. Eli Schaep's reflection helped you see that solo-amory isn't about being alone. It's about being whole. It's a radical act of self-trust, of building relationships from a place of autonomy rather than expectation. Before we wrap up today's episode, I want to thank our sponsor, Wifey, a media brand reimagining what modern love can look like. Wifey offers a nuanced, sex-positive, and emotionally intelligent exploration of ethical non-monogamy. Their visually stunning content goes beyond sensationalism to spark honest conversations around relational wellness, challenge outdated stereotypes, and encourage curiosity and compassion in how we think about love, trust, and desire. Visit wifey.vmg.studio or follow them on Instagram at wifeyupdates to explore exclusive stories, videos, and real-life perspectives that might just shift how you think about connection. If this episode inspired you or got you curious, please follow, subscribe, and leave a review to wherever you're listening to the podcast. Your support helps us keep these brave, beautiful conversations going. Until next time, stay curious and stay connected.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.